Hi, I'm Nico, film and TV editor for Impact Magazine, and I'm joined by
James Herman, reviews editor for Impact Magazine.
And we thought about starting a new series that we're gonna call, for the minute anyways, James and Nico Have Never Seen, because the idea behind the series is we're gonna watch films that people have never, people usually would assume we've seen, or people in general would assume everyone who enjoys film has seen, that we've not seen. We found out there's quite a few of those, and yeah, we thought we'd talk about them, give our opinions on them, say why we haven't seen them before, why maybe that decision was wrong, right, and yeah, do you think that summarizes what we're going to do here?
Yeah, I think so. So we started off with Heat.
Yeah, that's because, the first film we've seen.
So we watched that quite a while back and never really did anything with it, so we're finally actually putting it to use. Yeah.
And also, excuse us if our memory about, especially some of the later scenes, is a bit hazy, because we have seen it quite a long time ago now. But yeah, hopefully it should be all right. So Heat is a movie by
Michael Mann, written and directed. It was released in 1995, and it was originally written for TV.
It stars Al Pacino and Robert De Niro together for the first time since The Godfather. And it essentially, just to give a brief plot overview in case you haven't seen it. Oh, that's trend building bell. I don't know if you can catch it up. Essentially, to give an overview about the plot, if you haven't seen it, it's a sort of a cat and mouse game between a detective played by Al Pacino called
Lieutenant
Vincent Hanna, and Robert De Niro's character.
Neil McCauley.
We remember that one. Essentially, it starts with a heist, and most of the movie, or at least the first half of the movie, is Al Pacino following these guys and kind of following leads to track these guys, directly following that heist. And then they're preparing to find a bank robbery. And that's the plot in a nutshell. And there's a lot of things to say about this film. I think a lot of people consider this film, you know, revolutionary or whatever, because of the groundwork that it set up for a lot of other things, especially in the sort of a bank robbery or you know action genre, I think. So we're going to talk a bit about that. But before we get into that sort of revolutionary aspect of it, I think James had something to say about the cinematography about it.
I think that is part of what makes it so revolutionary, is that it's generally viewed as a genre film, as a film noir, in the way that they use colour, especially a lot of blacks and blues, and that features all throughout, and the whole, lots of wide shots of LA at night, which feature a lot of the blacks and blues. But the real thing was that it was both a genre film and a drama, in a way. In fact, actually, Michael Mann said that Heat is a drama, not a genre film. So it's the idea that some people will view it as a crime drama and some people will view it as a genre film, because it's written like a crime drama, but it's shot like a film noir, very stylistic. So you've got this blend of realism in the acting and the dialogue and the stylized filming.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think part of the reason why because I knew about this film for a long time, but part of the reason why I never brought myself to actually see it is, well, there's two reasons. One of them is I get bored very easily in long films, and this movie was always, you know, it's about 2 hours and 50 minutes,
two
more
hours
or less.
And 50 minutes.
So it's quite a big ask to see in one sitting, but we did it. We made it through it, and so that's one of the reasons. And then also, I thought it was a bit, just the way it's shot and some of the shots seemed like it was very artistic, and again, I feel like some of that stuff usually bores me. But actually, when I started seeing it, I saw that the way it's shot, the cinematography of it being a noir film, matched really well with the plot, I thought.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was definitely a strength of it, I believe.
Yeah, well, also, yeah, I think I agree. I knew it was a long film, but it was one of those classics where you meant to see it. But actually, it didn't. I think the first time we watched it, we noticed a long time had passed, but it didn't feel that long.
It's not boring,
because
in the slightest.
it's not too slow, but also a lot of films, you know, a lot of, particularly in the action genre, it just feels relentless. Mm-hmm. It's just action, action, action. Whereas this has the big heist scene at the start, which introduces the action straight away. And then you've got the slow, it's all about building tension. So it's actually quite slow paced, but not in a boring way, because mm-hmm. the tension is always building and each scene builds upon the next. And there's about 5 different story threads throughout the film, so there's always something going on.
There's definitely always something going on. As you said, it's a movie that builds on itself. Yeah. So every subsequent scene kind of builds on the things that happened before it. But it never feels boring. It feels like you're along for the ride for the whole time. It's not like a lot of other action and sort of crime dramas that I've seen since, where it feels like it takes the detective the first hour and a half to figure out what's happening. And then because of it, the whole thing just feels a bit stale and a bit like you already know what's going on, and it's just, you're just waiting for the detective or whoever to catch up on that. And that feels very boring. Whereas here, you know, from the beginning, you know what's happening. You're in the ride with the detective. You're in the ride with the criminals as well. So that's another strong point of it. You kind of get both perspectives. Yeah. And that's not only represented in the time spent on screen, but also on the themes surrounding the movie, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think the way the action is done is very different as well to what we're used to, and I think that also was maybe an off-putting factor mm-hmm. for me with watching this film, because we're so used to this heavy CGI and these jump cuts the several different angle. You know, like the Bourne trilogy. Mm-hmm. There's you have like it's very jolty camera work and stuff, and you get it in like Transformers and mm-hmm. big CGI films.
Yeah.
Whereas here, particularly in the main heist scene towards the end, you've got a real focus on what's actually happening. Yeah. So you get a lot of long takes and a lot of follow shots where
there's a lot of
you
long
actually
takes.
Understand where everyone is in relation to each other.
Yeah.
Unlike other action scenes where you're literally just seeing punches flying and you have no idea what's going on because the camera's moving around so much.
Mm. Yeah.
And the reason they were able to do it was because they put in so much training. Like everything was researched to such detail. So all of the actors knew exactly how to use a gun, etc. So the camera could just actually like stay on them. There's a part in the heist scene where Val Kilmer's character is shooting and he has to change his magazine mm-hmm. and he changes it in about 2 seconds, and I read that the army or the US army use that clip, and they say if you can't change a magazine as fast as that actor, you shouldn't be in the army. And so basically like they were seriously well trained for like months in how to use firearms and stuff. So that it adds a sense of realism, and you don't need to have this jumpy camera work that hides the fact that they don't really know what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. No, you definitely can tell, especially with the use of long shots. As you said, you always know where everyone is. And there's quite a few characters, especially in the heist scenes. There's considering the criminals and you know the detectives. There's quite a few characters going on in all of these major scenes at the beginning and at the end, especially the end. But you never get confused, which I usually do. I get confused quite easily with things like that, especially in modern movies that have, as you said, a lot of jump cuts and CGI and explosions. You never get confused in this movie. And I think that goes to show the dedication that every individual put into this, whether it be the director with the shots or whether it be the actors with the training they did. So that's really, really impressive. Going back to what you were saying earlier about how this movie builds on itself. You said at the very beginning that it was based on a TV series. I don't know about you, but I can see that, because I read that as well. And I sort of rewatched the movie after that, and I could tell that a lot of the scenes and the things, it feels like the movie's very episodic in a sense. There's a lot of characters that you can think of as, you know, they just showed up for a scene, or you're like, oh, for example, I don't know what the driver's name is at the end, but essentially there's this character who is in all of the movie in short scenes, but you don't see his relevance until the last hour of the movie. And there's a lot of things like that, a lot of scenes that you're like, okay, this is not strictly relevant to the plot, but because there is a, because they come in relevance after, it kind of feels like TV series where you kind of see things develop through time and everything builds on one another. So I could definitely tell that it was built initially, or, you know, it's based on something that was built for TV.
Well, especially also because with TV series, often you have a lot of, not lead, there's obviously the two lead characters, but you have a lot of character development across more than just the lead characters, and you get a definite sense of that in this film where every character feels fully realised and fully fleshed out.
100%, yeah. Yeah, every character feels very real as well, their motivations. That leads me, I guess, to our next point, which is about, you know, the themes in the movie. And you can definitely tell that a lot of thought was put into this sort of relationship between the two detectives. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing that I noticed rewatching the movie especially is that whereas there's a lot of contrast, but there's also a lot of similarities between these two main characters.
Yeah.
So Robert De Niro is this criminal who is finding love for the first time, I suppose.
I think it's really interesting. They are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
And it's weird that, because Robert De Niro is the cool, calm, calculated criminal, whereas Al Pacino is the hot-headed cop, and you'd expect it to be the other way around.
Yeah.
So that there is a kind of a flipping, but also the fact that Al Pacino's character sacrifices his marriage in pursuit of De Niro, whereas De Niro's character actually finds himself motivated by his new relationship. So that's an interesting role reversal as well there.
And you can tell how, whereas of course they have very different lives, but their personal lives seem to be very much in tandem. So while Al Pacino's personal life is deteriorating because of his deteriorating third marriage with his wife, and he can't connect with his stepdaughter with all these problems, and De Niro on the other side comes from sort of his mentality of he wants to drop everything in 30 seconds flat when he feels the heat around the corner, but at the same time he's failing to act in the things that he says he stands for, because he's creating this relationship. He wants to, for a large part of the movie, he wants to escape to New Zealand with this woman. So it kind of feels like they're both acting out of character, like they're doing all these things in their private lives. Like, you know, the cop is doing all these things to protect people, but it feels like he's sacrificing a lot of his personal life, whereas in De Niro's case, it's the opposite.
Well, like you said, like De Niro's whole thing is you got 30 seconds when the heat's on, and yet later in the film, he says, there's no point in going anywhere if it's going to be alone.
Yeah,
so
of course.
But actually, in the end, he does decide he's got 30 seconds to drop everything right at the end.
Right at the end. And does he do it, James?
He does.
He does. He drops it.
So he actually does a 180.
And I think one thing that I really... Another, just going back to this point of the, you know, the two characters acting in tandem, one thing that I noticed as well is there's also a lot of, as much as there's similarities in, you said, there's two parts of the same coin, they're very different in a lot of respects. And one part where I particularly found that interesting is in the coffee scene, a coffee shop scene. Which I think you might reenact later.
I do.
But one thing that's very interesting in that scene is they talk about the dreams they've had, and Al Pacino's dream is all about being sat at a table with all the victims of the murders that he's not, that he's been capable of, the people that he's not been able to save, essentially. And they're just looking at them, they're not saying anything. And all the while he's telling the story, Al Pacino's just sat there, like, nodding, really uninterested, and really, like, De Niro, sorry. Yeah, De Niro sat there very uninterested and very, like, he just doesn't seem to comprehend why he carries this sort of guilt around, why the detective carries this sort of guilt around. Whereas De Niro's dream is all about himself. It's all about he's drowning and he feels like he doesn't have the time to do all the things he needs. So there's this sort of selfishness on De Niro's part, which Al Pacino doesn't have. He feels more guilt because he's not been able to save people. And De Niro feels like this makes no sense. So they have a lot of clashes in personality that are quite apparent in the dialogue.
I think the cafe scene is the focal point of the film.
Yeah, agreed.
This is something that you might not actually know, but the film is inspired by real life stories.
Is it?
Yeah. So Neil McCauley was a real career criminal.
No way.
Yeah.
Was he actually?
And that that cafe scene is a reenactment of a real scene that happened. So in 1963, Detective Chuck Adamson sat down at a coffee shop with Neil McCauley and they talked it out. And I've got the transcript here. So Adamson says to him, you realise that one day you're going to be taking down a score and I'm going to be there. And McCauley says, well, look at the other side of the coin. I might have to eliminate you.
Wow. That's the real conversation.
Well, almost, yeah. And then
in the movie,
1 year later, Adamson catches McCauley in a heist. He sat outside waiting for him. Big chase ensues. Sound familiar?
Yeah. But also, I never knew that. That's crazy.
So the cafe scene is entirely inspired by that actual real-life event.
The transcript. Wow.
Because if you listen to what Pacino and De Niro say to each other, it's actually very similar.
What do they
say? And I'm going to do a rather crude impression. So Pacino says to De Niro, he's looking all intense, and he goes, if I'm there and I got to put you away, I won't like it. But if it's between you and some poor bastard whose wife you're going to turn into a widow, then brother, you are going down.
Yeah.
And De Niro pauses and he nods and he looks back at him and says, yeah, but there's a flip side. So what if you do got me boxed in? I will not hesitate, not for a second. And then he says, maybe we never see each other again. And in the original transcript,
sorry. This feels like I'm there with the actual Al Pacino.
Yeah, apologies for that crude impression.
No, don't apologize.
It's interesting because in the original transcript, I think McCauley says we'll meet again, and that's the end of their conversation.
Right.
So it's crazy how it feels so realistic, but at the same time, it's like what a crazy story.
Yeah.
But the realism is actually built on
the real.
On
the fact. It's real. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It almost feels too good to be true. Yeah.
But that's how they've brought that real sense of realism into it, because the research that Mann did for the film was
insane.
Extensive, and he talked to the real Neil McCauley, and he talked to loads and loads and loads of cops and stuff.
You can tell.
Yeah. It was so thoroughly researched.
There's quite a few scenes where I was like, I felt like I didn't understand, but it felt very real. Like the way that they lead, how they're all halfway through the movie, they're all essentially chasing the different members of the band, and they've got surveillance on them, and it felt very real, how they led their investigation.
Yeah.
You can definitely tell.
They had a lot of experts on scene with them, and especially in that, are you talking about the bit where they're going to steal something and then they have to bail?
Yeah.
So that one, they, I think they actually had McCauley talk about his experiences, and he's like, he'd be able to see one thing out of line and know that if this one thing happens, the chances of getting caught just go up exponentially. And he's like, that was his thing. He was like, if anything didn't go to plan, it wasn't worth it, and he'd bail.
Yeah, that's a good point. He's it feels like he has a lot of knowledge of how law enforcement works.
Yeah,
which I don't know if you did your research. I don't know if that has anything to do with the real character having all this knowledge. He knows, as you said in that scene, I don't know how, but he has an inkling that I think there's a noise or something.
Yeah.
And he realizes that he's being watched, and he drops everything. He knows that they're not going to go after it because they're not going to get them some misdemeanor.
The thing that connects the two main characters so well is that they have to get inside each other's heads to understand each other. So, De Niro has to think like a cop to not get caught, and at the same time Pacino has to dive in and become a criminal to catch him. And I think it takes one to know one, right? That's the idea, is that he's got to get inside the psyche of the criminals to catch them.
And do you think it works out for either of them? Do you think leading to the end, do you think it works out for any of them?
It's interesting. Mm. I mean, I think anyone who hasn't seen the film yet is 20-something years old, so I think you've lost your right to
to claim
say
spoiler
no
alert.
Spoilers.
Yeah.
But I think because obviously at the end, Pacino does kill De Niro in a big standoff in an airfield.
Yeah.
But in that moment, he's not like I've got the bastard or anything.
Mm-hmm.
He holds De Niro's hand, and they have such a mutual respect for each other, and it's that idea that they're bound together in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And he says in the coffee scene, if I got to put you away, I won't like it, because they kind of need each other,
of course,
to push them further. And that's an interesting parallel to a certain other film called The Dark Knight.
Oh, is this where we start talking about The Dark Knight parallel?
Well, the idea that, because they need each other, yeah, and it's like the same idea as the Batman and the Joker. And
yeah, of course.
Because Batman won't kill the Joker, and Joker won't kill the Batman, because the Joker says, I don't want to kill you, you complete me. Because he needs, they both need each other.
And it's exactly like it feels like he feels almost sad that he did, and it relates a bit to The Dark Knight, because, you know, if at the very end when Batman catches the Joker, it almost feels like it's the end, it leaves him a bit incomplete, and then you can consider it in parts with Heat. Al Pacino, the chase for Al Pacino is all his life, it's all he's been doing for the past whatever time. He doesn't, his personal life is in the bin. He doesn't have any sort of connection to his personal life. So when he catches De Niro, or when he kills De Niro, there's a sense of, and what now?
Yeah.
Kind of, which you know, is very powerful.
I don't think anyone really wins.
Yeah, no one wins.
Because technically, you know, Vincent wins
because
he gets Macaulay, but there is that hollowness, and obviously Macaulay doesn't win because he gets killed, and Edie gets abandoned by Macaulay. Yeah.
And there's all these
at the end. And Val Kilmer's character, he has to drive away from his wife because otherwise, like, he's drawn into a trap.
So it's
no one really has a happy ending.
No, yeah, and there's all these. I think Mann was it, the director?
Yeah,
he's trying to make a big point with a lot of this, and I think that this, as I said earlier, this character is a driver at the end who feels a bit irrelevant to the main plot of the story, because he has his own plight with his worker at the job that he takes on, and he gets approached by De Niro's character near the end and gets asked to join their heist session because they've lost the driver, and he gets killed fairly early in the heist at the end. And, you know, I stood there and I watched it the first time, I was like, what an irrelevant character, this is a fault of the movie. But seeing it a second time, I can't really say it's a fault of the movie, because I think the point he was trying to make is that there's all this senseless loss that happens because of, you know, because they say the struggle that is at the center, that, you know, your eyes are focused on between the detective and the robber. That sort of mouse and cat game that dominates all your attention, there's all this loss that happens around them because of it, and your attention maybe isn't as focused on it, but it should be, because it's a lot of dead characters, a lot of families destroyed because of their actions. This man who got involved really just because he didn't like his job, he's murdered quite quickly in a gruesome way and leaves, you know, a girlfriend behind. And I think that's a big point that he tries to make with this, is that this obsession between these two people has caused all this pain.
In the shootout, like the noise alone, you can tell like how much is going on. Like it's deafeningly loud.
Yeah.
But there's so much collateral damage in it, where there are civilians just like fleeing, and Vincent is literally telling people to get down, and he's chasing Macaulay, and you think, why is he doing that? Like it's not worth the risk, especially when one of the other guys picks up a little girl and uses her as like a human shield.
Yeah.
And he still shoots the guy, even though he's got a hostage. Like, he could have killed the child, but it's because he's like so focused on catching Macaulay that he doesn't even care about the collateral damage.
Yeah.
Which is like, I mean, that's not what a police officer should do. But he lives in that grey area because he just gets so, it's an obsession with wanting to catch De Niro, and De Niro's got an obsession with wanting to win.
Yeah.
And wanting to beat Pacino.
Yeah. They're both really selfish in their own right, aren't they?
Mm.
Whether it's the detective with his... Vincent Hanna. I don't know why I keep referring to him by the actor's name. I just can't seem to remember their names. They're both really selfish. He's selfish in his own work, and Al Pacino's selfish in his work. And, you know, it's the portrait of these two really selfish men, essentially, in the movie, and the destruction they leave behind. But yeah, I definitely think that's a big point that the director was trying to make. Do you have anything else to say?
Unstoppable force.
immovable meets object. Meets an immovable object. I wonder where that's from.
But it is that. Is
yeah.
De Niro is the unstoppable force and Pacino is the immovable object that won't be beaten.
Yeah. So, do you have any final thoughts on this film, James?
I would say go see the movie if you haven't already. Mm-hmm. Or if you have, watch it again because... Mm-hmm. I think on repeat viewings, you'll find so many more nuances and so much more
100%.
To the film.
There's a lot of details in this film.
And
watch it.
Even if you don't want to watch the whole film, watch the interrogation scene.
Mm-hmm.
The cafe scene.
And compare it to James's spot-on impression. And then tell me which one's better.
Yeah, let's not. But that scene, like, you get everything you need to know from both characters in that one scene. And it's such a... intense moment because that's the first time they meet, but they have such a strong respect for each other.
Yeah, I think that's gonna be my final thought. I really like that movie, so definitely
should we give it a score?
Yeah, you give it your score. I'll give it my score. I'm gonna give it. I want to give it 9, but I do feel like it does feel a bit disjointed at times, again because of that episodic sort of nature of it. So. Can I give it 0.5s or am I cheating?
It's a bit cheating.
I'll give it a 9. I'll give it a 9. The only reason why it's not a 10 is because it does feel a bit disjointed at times. It feels like things just sort of happen. But it's an almost perfect film in terms of cinematography, acting, character development, themes, message. It's to me, it's an almost perfect film. And I'm glad I watched it. How about you?
I think I'm going to give it a 9 as well.
A 9. Okay, good.
So, Heat, 9 out of 10.
Heat, 9 out of 10. The verdict is in Impact Magazine. okay, so we are going to put our heads together and decide what movie we're going to watch next. What do you think? What's in our list?
Top Gun.
We haven't seen Top Gun. Neither of us have seen Top Gun. We're afraid to say it, but hopefully we'll see it and we'll come... back with some positives on it, or maybe not so positives. It is Tom Cruise, and I feel like he's very hit or miss, but who knows. But yeah, I think that'll be it for this podcast on Heat, on Nico and James I've never seen. The title might change next week, we're still working on it. But thank you so much for listening in if you got up to this point. And yeah, see you in 2-3 weeks time. We really haven't figured out the schedule. Hopefully we will next time. We'll see when we've seen Top Gun.